Please be seated. You see the authority. You recognize immediately the authority. Nobody care about what I'm saying. So you may have the impression that the panelists are not here, but they are here. So I think it's time also, again, as an Italian, I have no problem with delay or starting late, but I think I should give a different impression of myself. So let's start sharp. Again, the panelists are all here, but since Fernando Bordin of the University of Cambridge is presenting a PowerPoint, he will be alone. Now, perhaps you are aware, as Samantha said yesterday, that this is a, let's say, a different session in the sense that we have three presentations today, and the reason is that Judge Georg Nolte could not join us today. The organizer, I think, wisely decided to start a bit later in order to have to give us more time to ponder about the rich debate of yesterday. And but this does not change the time allotted to each presentation, which is in between 20 to 30 minutes. And I will be there checking your time, Fernando. So you have the floor. And let's start.
Bonjour. Thank you very, very much for the invitation, Professor Besson. It is a real pleasure to be here with you today to talk a little bit about the role of the consent of international organizations, IO consent, as I will be referring to it, in international lawmaking. Now, international organizations have been around for a long, long, long time. But we still don't know enough about their status as subjects of international law, about how exactly they fit within the decentralized legal system of sovereign states that we still have. So we still debate the nature of their legal personality, we still debate what rules apply to them as they relate with the outside world, and we also debate how they contribute to the making of international law. And for sure, the status of international organizations as international legal subjects, it raises many questions. And one of those questions, I think, falls squarely within the theme of this conference. And the question is, to what extent the consent of international organizations is a necessary element in the creation of rules that apply to those organizations on the international plane, or we could go even a little bit further in the, for the creation of rules that apply to other participants in the legal system as well. In my presentation, I will focus on the role of IO consent in the creation of rules of custom. But I will say a few words about the role of IO consent in the law of treaties towards the end. But before I go there, I just wanted to make two brief clarifications. The first is that in the presentation, I'll be using the term consent a little bit loosely. In the sense of agreement, the descriptive sense that Professor Lefkowitz has mentioned yesterday in his presentation and paper, but broadly enough so as to comprise not only express assent or any form of agreement that we would call contractual, but also to encompass participation here in the making of international law. And then the second clarification that I wanted to offer is that when I speak about international law making, my focus is on the rules that apply to international organizations on the international plane. I'm not talking here about the internal rules that make up the internal legal system of each and every organization. Of course, internal rules are created in the first instance by the members of the organization themselves when they set up the organization, and later perhaps by the political organs of the organization. And those internal rules are of the greatest importance. They are most of what those international organizations do. But the question I'm asking is not about them. The question I'm asking is rather about the role of consent of international organizations to rules that apply to those organizations, qua subjects of international law operating on the international plane. Let's turn then to the question of the role of IO consent in the creation of custom. It is often said that international organizations are subject to the rules of customary international law. And we even find some authority in support of this proposition in the case law of the ICJ itself. That authority comes from a passage from the advisory opinion that the court gave to the World Health Organization in 1980, where the court says that international organizations are subjects of international law and as such are bound by any obligations incumbent upon them under general rules of international law. But the applicability of custom to IOs is not self-evident. Even the words that the court is employing in the dictum that you see projected on the slide, they are not entirely clear as to which rules apply to IOs and what the basis for that is. The court is not really telling us when an obligation under general international law will become incumbent upon an international organization. We know that obligations under general international law, in particular customary international law, become incumbent upon states because those rules derive from normative practices in which states partake. In a system where the customary process is accepted as a legal source, perhaps the legal source. Customary law rules, they are not valid, as many of the speakers yesterday have mentioned, because states have expressly consented to them. But if we understand consent again very loosely, in the sense of a degree of state consensus, that we can infer from the fact that states are following certain practices to begin with, then we can say that there is a connection, however indirect, between custom and state consent. But what about international organizations? When does a customary rule apply to an international organization? Does the IO have to be involved? Does it have to participate in the making of the customary rules that become incumbent upon them, as is the case with states? And I start with some thoughts from one of the most prominent and sophisticated commentators on the law of IOs at the minute, Ian Klabers, who, talking about this problem, has cautioned against interpreting the ICJ's dictum as confirmation that customary rules that apply to states can be extended to international organizations. And you see on the slide a quote from a chapter that he wrote for a volume edited by Samantha Besson and Jean d'Apremont, the Oxford Handbook on the Sources of International Law. And I apologize for the length of the quote, but it is a quote that is really worth digging in. Customary law, on any plausible conceptualization, is a law that results from the aggregate of activities of the members of a bounded political community. In international law, this is traditionally the community of states. Likewise, within states, the scope of customary law is often said to be limited to the members of the specific community, nation, tribe, people who practice the custom concerned. Hence, Klabers continues, claiming that the court must have meant that customary international law is binding on international organizations, ignores the circumstance that organizations are not part of the relevant political community. And if they are so considered, if they are part of the relevant political community, they should be treated on equal footing with the other members. And that leads Ian Klabers to say that holding that international organizations are bound by customary international law is difficult to reconcile with the very idea of custom. So Klabers is arguing here that there is something wrong with suggesting that IOs can be bound by custom to the creation of which they have not contributed. And he suggests that as a result, there are very few customary rules that govern the conduct of IOs qua subjects of international law. Now, Klabers is right in highlighting that any argument about the applicability of custom to interest organizations, it needs to tackle the question of the role of IO consent. But his analysis has at least one blind spot. He is completely right and plausible in noting that a system of customary law, in a system of customary law, the law results from the aggregate of activities of the members of a bounded political community. But it is not necessarily the case that the scope of customary law must be limited to the members of the specific community that develops the custom. Rather, it is perfectly possible for a legal system to comprise more than one category of legal subject and allocate different roles to each category when it comes to lawmaking. In other words, there is nothing that prevents a legal system based on customary law from electing the aggregate of activities of a certain class of members as jus generative, as resulting in law, and from providing that the resulting rules that that class of legal subjects are developing be applied to other classes of members. And I would like to illustrate this point with a simple example from international law itself. Individuals are considered as subjects of international law because international law sometimes addresses the individual directly. We see that in the field of human rights law, under treaty and custom. We see that in the field of international criminal law. Some would suggest that we see that in the field of investment law as well. What is fairly clear is that in this day and age, an individual may enjoy a customary right, say under human rights law, or may incur criminal liability under, say, a rule of customary international criminal law. But no one would suggest that there is something odd about that because the individual has not participated in the practice that has generated, that has developed into the customary rule that applies to him or her. And that is because individuals, they may be subjects of international law, they may be participants in the international legal system, but they are not lawmakers under the international legal system. And the same can be true of international organizations themselves. It is perfectly possible to conceive of a legal system where the aggregate of activities of states, to go back to Klaber's phrasing, will result in law that applies to international organizations as well. But there is another potentially relevant dimension to Klaber's analysis and the analysis perhaps of other commentators that we need to consider here as well. Perhaps the main point is not that states can theoretically make custom for other subjects of international law, including IOs, but rather that there is something wrong, something odd with treating IOs, as Klaber suggests, as second-class citizens. That perhaps IOs should be treated on an equal footing with states when it comes to the making of customary international law. But is that a persuasive proposal, I ask? And my intuition is that no, not necessarily. And that is because international law remains a system committed to the principle of the sovereign equality of states. It is well accepted, of course, that states can create separate legal persons, international organizations, to take collective action. But if sovereign equality is to be maintained as a structural principle of the system, those separate legal persons, they must be subjected to the default rules, to the ground rules that apply to states when those states act individually. Otherwise, if we made the consent of IOs essential to the application of custom to them, international law would enable a group of states to create an IO for the purpose of disregarding customary obligations owed to third parties, to third states, to other entities. If you don't want to comply with the rule of immunity of state X, What do? Just create an infrastructure organization and tell it to exercise jurisdiction over state X, making sure never to in any way consent to the rules of state immunity. If you want to circumvent the rules on the law of the sea, instead of flying ships or extracting natural resources yourself, do that through an international organization and make it sure that the organization will never express its consent in no way to the rules codified in the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. Of course, it is not surprising that we don't see those kinds of claims being made in practice. We don't see states, we don't see IOs even, at least not directly, arguing that somehow they are allowed to ignore the customary rights of third parties. There seems to be no appetite for a legal system that would allow states to contract out of customary rules by acting through a separate legal person. And that is why it makes little sense to think of the consent of IOs as essential, as necessary for the creation or application of custom to them. The point is that the international organizations, they are created by states to pursue all kinds of goals, but that those organizations have not replaced states as the basic units of the international legal system. And that's partly because, as Professor Besson mentioned in her introductory remarks yesterday, there are doubts about how international organizations represent the peoples of the world. And when they do represent the peoples of the world, which peoples are represented or sometimes over-represented as well. So IOs do not have an automatic claim for equality with states when it comes to making customary international law. And it is not unfair to suggest that they will be bound by the rules that states develop through sharing certain normative practices on the international plane. We are not treating them really as second-class citizens. Now, does that mean that international organizations don't participate, qua subjects of international law, in the creation of custom? I would not go that far, and I don't think that we should be going that far. The question has been discussed in a recent study of the International Law Commission on the identification of custom, and the conclusion to which the commission has arrived was mentioned by Professor Broman in her presentation yesterday. The ILC has suggested that in certain cases, the practice of international organizations also contributes to the formation or expression of rules of customary international law. Now, there are lots of questions that are raised by the ILC's work on this issue, and the ILC fails to deal with lots of issues that arise here, not least the issue of opinio iuris, as Professor Broman mentioned yesterday. But the basic point that the Commission is making here, which is a valid point for us to consider, is that if states act collectively through international organizations, the practice of international organizations will be relevant for the creation of customary rules. And the Commission identifies three scenarios in which that is the case. The first scenario is when organizations are given exclusive competence to act, as is the case with regional integration organizations, such as the European Union. So if a state commits not to act anymore and have the IO itself and exclusively acting on their behalf, the practice of the IO should be considered for the purposes of identifying customary international law. Then secondly, and more broadly, the ILC suggests that when international organizations exercise powers that are functionally equivalent to the powers exercised by states, that kind of practice also contributes to the creation, expression, identification of customary international law. And then third, the ILC recognizes that IO practice may contribute to the emergence of rules addressed specifically to international organizations, and that stands to reason. How can rules tailored to international organizations, rules that distinguish between international organizations and states, for example, ever emerge without some involvement on the part of the international organizations themselves? So to go back to Klabas's point from before, the IOC is implying that in some ways international organizations are part of the relevant political community in which customary rules are born. But it's important at the same time to understand the rationale for the approach that the IOC is taking for considering international organizations as part, to a certain extent, of that political community. And to think in particular about how we can square the significance of IO practice in the creation of custom with the principle of sovereign equality, which again underpins the system and in particular the creation of customary international law. The idea behind the Commission's conclusion is that custom results not only from the practice of states when they act individually, but also from the practice of states when they act collectively, even through a separate legal person. And if we were to remove the practice of IOs from the picture, the effect would be that we would be removing as well a chunk of state practice from the picture. Because if IOs cannot contribute to custom, then states who are choosing to act through IOs instead of acting individually, they would be penalized by the system. Their capacity to contribute to custom as sovereign equals would be diminished, and that would be done on the artificial ground that it's not the states that are acting, but rather who is carrying out the practice is a separate legal person that somehow does not get to contribute to this process at all. So it can be conceded that even if the practice of IOs is not necessary, a necessary element for the emergence of rules of custom, even rules of custom that applies to IOs, it will be sometimes a contingent element in the formation of customary rules. The practice of IOs can contribute to custom with the caveats that have been covered and some others that have not been covered but are covered in the paper. And it has to be considered as well that this contingent element in the formation of custom here, it can be a very, very important one, because the more powers states transfer to international organizations, the more relevant the practice of international organization will become. And sometimes a group of states can find it much easier to influence the customary process by acting en bloc through an international organization such as the European Union than if they were just to divide and conquer, acting unilaterally, which is probably why I imagine the United States of America was pretty much against this conclusion that the IOC has reached in its study on customary international law. The US did not want the IOC to include international organizations in the picture. Now, turning very briefly to the question of IO consent in the creation of treaty rights and obligations. In the codification of the law of treaties, there was a tendency to extend to international organizations the rules that apply to treaties between states. So if you take a look at Article 11, Paragraph 2 of the 1986 Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, you'll see that it provides that the consent of an international organization to be bound by a treaty may be expressed by signature, exchange of instruments, act of formal confirmation, acceptance, approval, accession, any other means if so agreed, as is the case with states with just one cosmetic terminological distinction. And likewise, Article 34 of the 1986 Convention provides that a treaty does not create either obligations or rights for a third state or a third organization without the consent of that state or that organization. Now, it seems quite straightforward that an IO can only conclude a treaty, can only become a party to a treaty, if the IO expresses its consent to be bound. The underlying principle in Article 11 seems to be readily applicable to international organizations. But the application of the principle found in Article 34, the so-called pacta tertius rule, it is more problematic when you think about relations involving IOs, member states, and third parties. And that is because it is not quite obvious that an IO should be treated as a third party in relation to the treaties that its members conclude, or vice versa. And indeed, there have been a few proposals to tweak the rules in Articles 34, 35, and 36 of the 1969 Convention, so as to make it easier for IOs to express consent to each other's treaty obligations. All those proposals were unsuccessful, and if you want to read a little bit about that, I strongly recommend the work of Kiki Brohlmann, who is absolutely wonderful in telling us that story and explaining what the problems were with the proposals and the way they were dealt with. But I don't intend to get into details of the record of the codification of the law of treaties. I will rather restrain myself to raising one single point which I find particularly troublesome and interesting as well. Looking at the record of the codification of the treaties in which international organizations participate, what I find striking is a total absence of a debate about the position of international organizations vis-a-vis treaties concluded by the entirety of their membership. The absence of any debate about whether an organization should have to consent to treaties that are binding on all the member states of that organization. One can understand why member states should not be automatically bound by a treaty concluded by an international organization, especially if that treaty was concluded by majority. The decision to conclude the treaty was taken by majority within the organization. One can also understand why an organization should not be automatically bound by treaties concluded by only some member states, like bilateral treaties that some member states may be concluding with third states. But why should an organization need to consent to a treaty that is binding on its entire membership? I'm thinking here of treaties like the UN Charter, human rights treaties, IHL conventions, environmental law treaties. It looks very odd that the European Union, for example, is not legally required, at least as a matter of public international law, I'm not talking about EU law, to comply with the UN Charter. And we have seen in recent years some striking examples of EU law and UN law clashing in very awkward ways. Just to mention a very recent exchange, the UN Secretariat has recently complained about the impact of the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation of the EU, on the operation of organizations within the UN system. And one of the arguments that the Secretariat is raising is that the EU is acting contrary to the privileges and immunities that the UN enjoys under the General Convention on the Privileges and Immunities of the UN. Now, all EU members are a party to the General Convention, but the EU itself is not a party. And so that leaves the UN without a direct legal claim to enforce rights that every single EU member owes to the UN under the convention, but the organization itself does not. And we end up with a situation where the consent of IOs, it may not be essential to the creation or application of custom to them, but it remains essential to the application of treaties to them, even those treaties to which the entirety, again, of their membership is a party. And that reflects, in my view, two distinct and somewhat conflicting visions of the role of the consent of IOs as legal persons separate from their members. Visions that result in part from policy preferences of states finding it advantageous to keep this distance between themselves and their organizations, especially vis-a-vis third parties. But also perhaps some of those tensions result from the tentative and incremental way in which the law of international organizations has been developing. And that means that our journey towards a coherent framework for inserting IOs into the international legal system of states, it must surely continue. We are not done yet. That concludes my presentation. Thank you very much.